Dark Winter Nights is produced with support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks Communication and Journalism Department, UAF COJO. Tell great stories. Welcome to the Season 4 finale of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Tough Alaskan Women episode. I love Alaskan women. They are badass. They can field dress and pack out a moose and then make the best enchiladas you've ever eaten in your life. They can look just as good in a pair of extra tufts as they do in a cocktail dress, and sometimes they wear them together. And they can tell stories that would make any man's jaw drop. In this episode of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, we have two very different stories from our April 2019 live event. First up, we'll hear Linda Bodie and Kat Kirshner tell a story about a dip netting trip they went on out on the Chitna.
This is the only opportunity these guys are going to have for the next 10 or 12 hours to get rescued. So I quick untie myself, I rip off my life jacket, I run over to our gear, I grab our flashlight, I'm blowing on my emergency whistle, and I'm just making an absolute scene of myself, jumping up and down on this little bit of a sandbar we've got going on, just trying to get their attention.
I was fishing. So I love to fish. I will not be deterred.
Then we'll hear Taryn Hughes tell the story of her daughter Esme's birth, which, as you could probably guess from the fact that you're hearing this on Dark Winter Nights, did not go exactly according to plan.
I'm looking at the floor in the entryway, and I'm like, this floor is entirely too dirty to have a baby on. And I don't want to clean my bathtub again. So we got to try to get to the hospital.
All of that is up next on Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Tough Alaskan Women episode. I'm Rob Prince. Linda Bodie and Kat Kirshner went on a chartered dip netting trip on the Chitna a few years back. If you haven't yet heard how dip netting the Chitna works, here's how it goes in a nutshell. You perch on the side of a cliff over a raging, icy river and stick a giant net in the water and wait until a salmon swims into it. While doing that, you're trying not to trip over a rope you've used to tie yourself to a sturdy tree, so your companions can more easily retrieve your body after you fall into the river and freeze to death. That's been more or less my experience, but minus the part about catching any fish. I apparently just do it for the scenery and exercise. At any rate, their story picks up shortly after being dropped off at their very remote overnight fishing spot, which was inaccessible by any means other than boat. After getting dropped off, Linda and Kat quickly got organized and started to fish. They shared this story at our March 2019 live event in Fairbanks.
We get all set up, roped up, and we start to fish, and they're hitting, and we're getting them, and we're getting about six an hour.
Yeah. Five, six, we get getting upwards of 10 and 12 sometimes, so this is good fishing by Chitna standards.
Right, so like it's like, wow, we're gonna get our limit here, this is really great, fish are running. And then we see this little skiff come down across the river from, just pass us, and these guys are in there, and they're like fishing out of this like really tenuous looking boat. It was a real sketchy little boat.
It's a Harding Lake type boat. It's not a Chitna boat.
Yeah, and so they see us and they wave and, hey, how are you guys doing? Are you catching fish? And we're like, yeah. And sometimes we'd have one and we could hold it up, and they're like giving us the thumbs up, and they're fishing too, and they're saying they're getting about the same amount, and they're checking in and out with us.
That went on for about 2.5 hours.
Yeah. So then they come along and they go, we're done. We're calling it a night. You girls have good evening, and they kind of waved to us, and off they went.
About a half hour later, this boat with no motor and one guy with a paddle leaning out over the side, paddling frantically, comes drifting by. The guy who's not paddling is going, send help! Send help! And we're like, we can't help! We don't have a boat. We don't even have a cell phone. We don't have one of those satellite emergency things.
And they go down really quickly. And the last thing we said were, we're overnight. We're staying overnight.
Have
and kind of waved to them. And that was it. So off they go toward Cordova.
100 miles downstream. Luckily, we were able to keep visual contact on them. So as they drifted on down, you know, I'm looking and looking, and sure enough, they were able to get onto a gravel bar or sandbar or something. They weren't on the shore. They were still in about knee-deep water, but at least they weren't going any further downstream.
Right, which so was we knew they were. Nice. They were safe.
They were going to be safe.
At least they were safe, yeah. So
safe.
Safe, yeah. So we keep fishing, and we got our eye on them, and we're fishing, and we're still pulling fish in.
Nothing we can do.
Yeah. So, and then we hear a motor. And on the other side of the river, coming out by Haley Creek, we see this boat.
This is the only opportunity these guys are going to have for the next 10 or 12 hours to get rescued. So I quick untie myself. I rip off my life jacket. I run over to our gear. I grab our flashlight. I'm blowing on my emergency whistle. And I'm just making an absolute scene of myself, jumping up and down on this little bit of a sandbar we've got going on, just trying to get their attention.
I was fishing. So I love to fish. I will not be detoured. So all of a sudden, the boat turns, and they are coming our way. So as the boat's turning, and Kat is down on the shoreline, and
still
I'm still on the rocks, the boat turns, and I see these guys point to the shore, and as I look, here comes an adolescent grizzly bear running along the shoreline less than 5 feet from Kat.
And when I'm oblivious.
And she's like facing the boat, and the bear's coming this direction, and I went, "Cat, bear." And the bear kind of, I think it saw her, it was close enough. It was like, and as it looked, it made a quick jog up right through where we eventually put our tent, through there, and up the game trail, up on the cliff.
Up, he went up the cliff.
Up, went
yeah,
up.
We couldn't see.
And so
Lindy yelled, "Cat, there's a bear!" And I'm already making myself big and loud. I can't do anymore.
Right.
So at which point I kind of lose all pretense of being a tough Alaska woman. I scream like a little girl, and I go running over to the rock to be with Linda, because I know, you know, safety in numbers here.
And I'm like, "Don't run, please don't run. Just don't run toward me, you know?" So she gets up there, and in the meantime, these guys in the boat, they think we've called them over there because there's a bear there.
And we want to be away from it.
Yeah, and we want to get away. And then when we explain to them, no, that's not why we called you over. Right down the river, there's two guys in a boat that really need your help because their boat's dead, and, you know, you're kind of like their rescue right now. So they were like, "Oh, okay, that's fine." And so they said, "You guys good?" And we're like, "Yeah, we're fine." So we go back to fishing.
We go back to, what else can you do at that point? So sure enough, those guys went down, the three of them met up with the boat. Everybody went to shore, redistributed the fish and the gear and everything else, put everybody in the front boat. I guess they had all their gear in the dead boat. Yeah. And they come very slowly back up the river towards us, and they start to pull in.
Right. So they start to pull in, and they have it in their heads. These guys, they're like, "Okay, these guys that were down there, they're going to stay overnight. You guys are coming back with us to you know, the creek."
And I'm like, "Whoa, time out. Wait a minute.
No.
We paid our money. It's beautiful weather. There's great fishing.
And we're fishing, and now we're yelling. We're a little bit more aware. We're yelling, "Hey, bear. Hey, bear." So we're not like, you know, we're watching. You know, there was nothing there.
It's like, so we're like, we're good. You guys we'll do this tonight. You go ahead. We'll be up tomorrow, and if we're not, well, you know where we'll be.
Right. So the one guy says, he goes, "Well, do you want a firearm?" And I said, "Sure."
It's sounding a pretty good idea at this
point. Yeah, and I don't know anything about guns. I don't know what came over me. It was like, it felt good to say, "Sure, sure, we'll take your gun. Sure." So
now Linda's looking at me like, "Kat, you were in the military. You know everything about guns, right?" And I'm like, "The most dangerous thing they gave to me in the Navy was a computer, for crying out loud."
So when I said sure, five guys in a boat all jump up simultaneously, no joke, and they rip off their jackets, and they are packing. They've got ammo strapped across them. They've got a sidearm.
They've got machetes.
And they're arguing. They're arguing. They can have my gun. No. They're going to take our gun. No. And this one guy in the back of the boat, he's like, I've got the best point and shoot, and they're going to take this gun. And he, like, kind of walked to the front of the boat, and they brought their boat into the shoreline. And he was so excited about leaving us his gun, he jumped off the boat, missed the shore, went into about here, thighs in the water.
His friends are pulling him back.
To get him settled. And he's like all the time looking at his gun. And
this thing is the size of a small baseball bat. I mean,
yeah, you know the fish bat.
The kind we use to kill fish with.
Yeah, I mean, it was like that long. It was like, holy mackerel, you know, it's just... So they give us this gun.
And they're showing me, how to do this. Here's a safety. Here's how you, and everything like, got this. All right,
and
we're
I'm
tough
just
Alaska
letting
women.
Her do it because she's military and I'm not. You know? Yeah. I secured it. She can use it now. You know, it's fine.
So the guys, okay, didn't take our name, didn't take our number, anything else. They said, okay, well, see you tomorrow. Oh, and by the way, you can return this gun. We're just below the bridge, up on the main road there, white motorhome. Just drop it off tomorrow morning on your way out. And we're like, okay, bye, have fun.
No name or anything, and all of that's being told to us as they're like going out, and we're waving goodbye, and that was it. So then we have
then
this
we have the
gun.
Discussion.
Yeah. So we have this gun, and we fished a little while longer, and then decided, well, we're getting a little punchy. It was getting late, so we needed to get some sleep, and we could finish up with our limit in the morning.
Yeah, we had about 60 fish at the time, and it's like, okay, I'll go set up the tent. Linda kept fishing. All right, so I go set the tent up, and as I'm setting it up, it's like, how can I stake our claim anymore? So I go ahead and I start marking the territory around the tent, if you know what I mean, doggy style.
I had no idea that was going on. None. I was clueless to that.
So being again that it's, pretty much daylight 24/7, being up north here in Alaska, it's about 11:30 at night before we decide we're tired, we're starting to, get a little uncoordinated. Let's go ahead and just call it a night, throw our sleeping bags out.
Made sure that our fish were all secure and everything.
Yep.
And so
took off our stinky clothes, which are all totally covered in fish slime at this point. Right. Like the whole place doesn't reek of salmon, okay? And just leave our clothes and anything that we don't absolutely need, and we go shivering over to the tent and climb into our sleeping bags.
And then we have a discussion. It was like, Kat's like, let's get the gun in the tent. And I'm like, no way. No way. That was a deal breaker. It was like, no way. The gun, no, we don't need that.
Yeah,
in the tent.
Linda wasn't going to budge on this one. So we did come to a compromise. It was going to be on my side of the tent. I still don't know why. Underneath the fly out there, just outside the door, in case a bear comes in, like, I'm really going to stick my hand out to get the gun to shoot the bear in our own tent. So.
But it was secure.
And it was close.
It was secure, yeah. So it was all good.
All right. So we say goodnight, and Linda's head hits the pillow. 30 seconds later, she is absolutely sawing logs. I love you, Linda, but honey. At which point I started thinking about it, and it's like, if we're going to get mauled or eaten by a bear tonight, I might as well do it on a good night's sleep rather than sit up, listening for a bear, waiting for the bear to attack. So I stuck my earplugs in, and I'm no shrinking violet when it comes to snoring either. I don't even remember my head hitting the pillow. But anyway, it was lights out probably until, 5, 6 o'clock the next morning?
Yep. Got up, got dressed, finished off our limit, and there came Mark motoring up to get us. And so he pulls in, he asks, thumbs up. We give him a thumbs up that we got all our fish, and he comes into shore. And as he pulls into shore, we're transferring our fish into the buckets.
Loading up the gear.
Loading up the gear, cleaning up the spot. And then we say to him, oh, by the way, Mark, you need to do something with this. And we hand him this gun.
He gives us this look like, where'd you get that?
Yeah, yeah. So he looks at it and, he's like, takes the cartridge or the magazine or whatever it is, he takes it out of the gun, and there's people in the boat that he's dropping off to, and they're like looking, their eyes are kind of big, like going, whoa, those women have a gun.
Tough Alaska women.
And so we're like, at this point, it's like, yeah, we have a gun.
Yeah.
We have fish. First of all, we have fish, and we have a gun. So... Anyway,
we're not scared of bears.
No. Because we mark the territory. So we get back in the boat and we get over to to O'Brien Creek, and we get out and get our fish all settled in, and we go off down to Salmon Point.
Had no problem finding the guy with his motorhome, sitting around the fire, drinking a beer and everything like that. Hand the gun over to him, said, "Thank you very much, sir." He checked, make sure that it was all okay, and we never did find his name or get his name or number or anything like
that.
He's
like, "Did you girls have to use that?" And we went, no, we didn't see anything. We were all good.
Nope, we're good.
So gave him his gun, and then driving away, thought, only in Alaska can men fight and argue over giving you their gun, giving a woman their gun, and not even leaving a name, a number, an address, nothing. Just, here's the gun.
So, wherever you are, sir, thank you very much for your trust and confidence in us,
yeah.
And hopefully we'll have a chance to return the favor to somebody, just not with a gun.
Okay. Right. And
that's our story, and we're sticking to it.
Linda Bodie and Kat Kirshner. This is Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Tough Alaskan Women episode. I'm Rob Prince. Taryn Hughes was in the final stages of her pregnancy at the start of our next story. While this was Taryn's sixth child, it was her new husband's first baby, so this was all pretty foreign to him. They had already spent hours at the hospital earlier that night before being sent home because the birth process wasn't progressing along quickly enough. The couple was trying to settle in for some sleep before they headed back to the hospital the next morning. It wasn't too long, however, before it became apparent that they would not be getting any sleep that night. Sensitive listeners should know this story does include some of the grittier elements of the miracle of childbirth. Here's Taryn Hughes.
My contractions got pretty bad, and then my water broke, which was huge. You know, it's like redeeming, like something really is happening. You guys don't know what you're talking about. This baby's coming. But in the back of my mind, I was like, but they said I'm only 2.5 centimeters, so I have so much farther to go. And if I go back to the hospital and get sent home again, I don't know what I'm going to do. So even though my water had broken, even though I was shifting from like not able to speak to grunting and like trying not to push, I still needed someone else to tell me that I should go to the hospital. So I looked to my husband and I say, "Ben, what do you think we should do?" And he's like, "Well, I don't know. You're the one who's done this 5 times. So it turns into this, and this is another sign of active labor, transitional labor, where you start to like argue with people over nothing. Then I'm like, that doesn't matter. Every birth experience is different, and I need you to empower me in this moment. I am incapable. I need you to make this decision." And he's like, "Well, I want to sleep. I think we should try to sleep." Because she said, she said 2.5 centimeters. And I'm like, "But I know, but you don't understand this." Ooh, you know. So he's like, "Well, F it. We're going." So he's putting a pair of his pants on, and this is where it gets detailed. I warned you, you've been warned. There was, you know, fluid just coming out of me, and we get to the man door going into the garage, and I'm kind of holding open the door, and I look over and he's in the bathroom, like brushing his teeth. Because again, like, he's been a flight medic for, gosh, I think almost 17 years. And the one thing I've learned in my relationship with him is that when a baby is born in transit for flight medic, flight crews, or any kind of emergency transport crew, it's not a good thing. It's like, no, something went wrong. You didn't give him the right drugs, or something went wrong. So he doesn't have a lot of experience with the whole process of labor and delivery. So he's in the bathroom brushing his hair and like brushing his teeth, and my daughter comes out, my 18-year-old, because my grunting had woken her. And she's like, "Do you need me to grab a towel or something? Should we take this to the bathroom?" And I'm looking at the floor in the entryway, and I'm like, "This floor is entirely too dirty to have a baby on. And I don't want to clean my bathtub again." So we got to try to get to the hospital. So he comes out, and I said, I had checked myself for dilation, which I don't know what that feels like. I just know what it feels like to be trying not to push a baby out. And I had felt her head, but so had the nurse at the hospital, so had my husband, because he's able to check for dilation. What I had failed to mention to my husband was that when I felt her head, I felt her hair. Not like a bulge of a head, but like this fuzzy stuff. So we get in the truck, And he's like, we can make it, we can make it. And we start going down the drive, and I'm like, man, I'm trying so hard not to push. But 2.5 centimeters, there's just no way you go from 2.5 to 10 in like 15 minutes. That is unheard of. Well, I guess not. I guess it's not. I just didn't know. So I'm doing this thing. I have my pants, and I'm like pulling them down, and this is the dialogue in my head. My pants go down, and I'm like, she's coming. And they go back up, and I'm like, no, you're being dramatic. She's coming. You're being dramatic. She's coming. You're being dramatic. Stop it. And so I'm doing this all the while my husband is kind of trying to get to the hospital, and it's like 4 something in the morning, Wednesday now. And we're going down airport, we turn left from university. The light was red, of course, because that light is always red. But he did the dude thing, and he ran the light, kind of looked both, oh no, it's coming, okay. So we get through Washington and it's green. We get to Market, and I'm not even kidding you, the light was red. You know how those lights work, right? Like, I think, this could just be me, but I think they stay green unless there's some, especially in the middle of the night, unless there's someone on the crossroad, right? There was the most bent over old dude, I'm not kidding, on Market and an airport with a cane. I'm not kidding, it was like something from a Pixar movie. He's bent over this cane and he's like slowly walking across like that, and I'm like, you've got to be kidding me, this is not really happening. Like, I looked at my husband and he's like, this is nuts, and he was going so, maybe it was because I was in transition, but he was going so slow. So that was the moment that I knew I was not a drama queen. This baby was coming. And sure enough, we get, I don't know how many yards past Market. An old dude is looking over his shoulder because my husband had veered around him when he finally cleared our vehicle. He's like, I think he got a show. Because by that point, my pants were kind of down and I felt her head come out. And thankfully, she was face down. And she had a long cord. There were no cord issues. I was able to kind of get myself in a better position. And the rest of her came out. And I'm not kidding, I caught her like a football, like this. So both hands forward like this. And thank you. My fingers were curled around her collarbone, so kind of on her shoulder blades, and I just turned her into me just like a football. And she latched onto my left side right away. My husband is, you know, flight medic. He's like, oh no! Like, she's here, I kept saying, she's here. And then, okay, the medical training kicks in. He's like, okay, okay, okay. There's steam rise. It was like I plucked her out of Sheena Hot Springs. Like, because it was 12 below that day, and we keep our garage barely above freezing because you don't want to spend that money on heating oil, right? So just cold enough to act as a second refrigerator. So anyway, there's steam coming off of her, and he throws me this, because I was sweating when I left the house. I didn't have a coat. He tosses over this wool coat, this wool jacket that he was wearing, which we still have, by the way. And he's like, wrap her up in this. So we wrapped her up, and I got her under my shirt, and she was warm, and you know, she was nursing, and she was completely healthy, thank God, very happy, nursing baby. It was like nothing had ever happened. She was like, okay, where's the milk? I'm going to sleep now. It was great. And so we get to the hospital and we pull up and he goes in and gets a gurney and he said something to the staff and there, he was like, my wife just gave birth in the car. I need warm blankets. That's a dude. So he comes and he taps on the window and I'm sitting in the car covered in birth. And I'm holding her and I'm blissed out, right? Because what a cool story. And I was so vindicated, you guys. I was like, I was right. Like beyond, I think even more than I was happy that she was finally here, I was like, I knew it. So he taps on the door and I'm kind of like, he opens it and he's, oh, I'm like attached to this baby like a telephone. I can't move, I can't walk. And so by this point time, the OB staff and the ER staff had, there was just, it was like, you know those like Grey's Anatomy, they're all out there like ready. And he finally is like, okay, I'm gonna pick you up. Okay, I warned you. He picks me up, all this afterbirth, all over the seat of the truck, all over, it was like a murder scene. So there's that. It gets worse, okay? You thought that was bad. You should just leave right now. So they're all standing out there, and we both work for the same company. I do business development. He does flight medicine. He does the cool stuff. But I see these people all the time in the ER and the ICU and otherwise. And so beyond the fact that they'd all just seen all of my business, my husband being the ever-vigilant practitioner, he's like, looks over into the passenger seat, and he sees what he thinks is like a detached piece of the placenta or something, which isn't a good sign. And he picks it up, and he's like, you guys, I think this is important, but no, it's a turd. Then he says, the ravens will get it. I'm really sorry, FMH. I'm really sorry, ravens. I swear to God, I take a shovel with me when I camp. Give us this one time. It was an extenuating circumstance. So we get up to OB, and they were amazing. They kept joking about how they weren't going to be able to charge me for a full birth. That's right, I should have gotten paid by my insurance company for that. They were wonderful. The triage nurse came in, and she was deeply apologetic, and I told her that, you know, I've done this before. I made the choice to go home. I decided to fight, you know, my intuition with fear. It was my fault, not hers. And, you know, when you're in a learning environment like that, not all of your experiences are going to be those glorious, uplifting ones. You have to learn from somebody, and I'm okay with being the somebody. It was fine. They took great care of me. And she was back on OB triage the next day. So kudos to FMH. They treated me very well. Yes. <Hello? laughs> I learned a couple things. I learned to trust my intuition. In my case, my contractions. I learned that the hard way. I learned that experiences that aren't ideal make for great stories. And if you ever need an automotive detailer, I know a guy. Thank you.
Taryn Hughes, she shared that story at our March 2019 live event in Fairbanks. Thanks so much for listening to this season 4 series finale of Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska, the Tough Alaskan Women episode. This episode was produced by Ryan Peterson and edited by Ryan Peterson and myself. Story consultation by Lori Neufeld. If you've got a great true story from Alaska, we always want to hear it. You can submit your story online at darkwinternights.com. That's also where you can find links to all of our social media, listen to every episode we've ever produced, and stay in the loop about our upcoming live events. It's been a tradition for us to end each season finale episode with the Alaska flag song, so here it is, performed by the Alaska Chamber Singers and led by conductor David Hagen. Remember, these are the stories we tell up here in Alaska on Dark Winter Nights. I'm Rob Prince.